Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the black community. This week I'll have 7 readings, including a story about the black history of Appalachia from Travel Noir magazine, a New York Times story about the unemployment rate, an opinion piece about the lack of celebrity activism from Salon magazine, followed by 2 readings about celebrities, a profile of actor Tyler Williams from the New York Times, and a story about dancer Misty Copeland from the Associated Press. I'll wrap up with a theater review from the New York Times, and I'm starting with this. Meet the 5 MacArthur geniuses making the future black and brilliant. This was written by Liz Corquet-Lesaunaire and published October 8, 2025 at the website wordinblack.com. Black genius isn't rare, it's everywhere. Look no further than the announcement of the 2025 class of MacArthur Fellows for proof that black folks are reshaping how we tell stories, protect the planet, build community, and make music. This year, 5 black artists, scientists, musicians, and activists are among the 22 recipients of what's popularly known as the Genius Grant, an $800,000 no-strings-attached award from the nonprofit MacArthur Foundation. This year's crop of black geniuses is pushing the boundaries of creativity, innovation, and ideas that change our world for the better. Garrett Bradley, artist and filmmaker, New Orleans. The first black woman to win Best Director in the Sundance Film Festival's U.S. documentary competition for her documentary Time, which tells the stories of black women in Louisiana who have incarcerated loved ones. Bradley is no stranger to accolades. Her work combines elements of documentary, narrative, and experimental cinema to explore questions of justice, public memory, and cultural viability, according to MacArthur's announcement. Her acclaimed installation, America, reimagines early black cinema. Christina Douglas, archaeologist, New York City. Archaeologists research the past, but Douglas digs into bygone eras to try to save our future. Her community-engaged archaeology efforts in Madagascar includes local residents in her research team. Together, they investigate how people have adapted to climate shifts and what indigenous and descendant communities can teach us about survival and resilience. Tanika Lewis Johnson, photographer and social justice artist, Chicago. A lifelong Chicagoan, Lewis Johnson uses photography and public art to expose the roots and realities of racial segregation. Her folded map project pairs residents from the Windy City's predominantly white north side with those from the predominantly black south side to confront how policies shape folks' lives. Her projects, Inequity for Sale, and her latest, Unblocked Inglewood, document housing injustices and efforts to restore homes in need of repair. Craig Taborn, improvisational musician and composer, Brooklyn. Based in Brooklyn, Taborn is known for his genre-bending approach to music. I like to be surprised and excited by what's happening, he says. Through his mastery of piano and electronic keyboards, he delves into jazz, classical, electronic, rock, and hip-hop. He enhances musical collaborations and composition through his expansive exploration of sound, technique, and instrumentation, according to the MacArthur Foundation. William Tarpe, chemical engineer, Stanford, California. Most folks have no desire to think about sewage, but Tarpe believes it's full of potential. The Stanford University-based chemical engineer is developing technologies to recover and repurpose pollutants like nitrogen and phosphorus from wastewater. His pilot projects in Kenya and California could transform how communities deal with pollution, fertilizer shortages, and climate change. By reimagining waste as a solution, Tarpe is creating a path to sustainability centered on environmental justice. That was the reading titled, meet the five MacArthur geniuses making the future black and brilliant. It was written by Liz Corquet Lasonnet and published October 8, 2025 at the website wordinblack.com. My next reading is titled 7.5%, the unemployment rate for black Americans. The jobless rate for black workers has ticked up in the past 4 months to 7.5% from 6%. This article was written by Laura Kelly and published in the New York Times newspaper on Sunday, October 19, 2025. The joblessness rate for black workers has ticked up in the past 4 months to 7.5% from 6%. At the same time, the unemployment rate for white workers has dipped slightly to 3.7%. The decline in black employment, after a historically strong labor market, is a worrisome sign. During downturns, marginalized groups often see a larger hit to employment and take longer to recover, the New York Times' Lydia DePillis reported. A few factors have recently come together to fuel higher joblessness among black Americans. Federal layoffs have hit black workers disproportionately hard, and the cuts to federal jobs remove a pathway to employment for younger workers. The Trump administration's assault on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. In his first days in office, the president ordered employers to halt racial equity policies, is adding to the challenges. The slowdown in employment follows a strong few years for black workers. During the first Trump administration, black unemployment rates were low, though still twice the rate for white people. Federal subsidies helped soften the blow when the pandemic diminished in-person jobs, wages grew, and black household wealth rose to historic heights. But last year, as pandemic-era subsidies ran out, inflation persisted and hiring slowed, black households were the only racial group for which the poverty rate rose and median income fell, according to Census Bureau data. Now, the once strong labor market for black workers has been weakened. There's been such a rapid shift in policy rather than something cyclical or structural about the economy, Valerie Wilson, who directs the program on race, ethnicity, and economy at the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank, told Ms. DePillis. She recalled the recent changes out of the ordinary. That was the article, 7.5%, the unemployment rate for black Americans. This was written by Laura Kelly and published in the New York Times newspaper on Sunday, October 19th, 2025. My next reading is titled, Afrolatia Exists, The People Reclaiming Black Identity in Appalachia. This was written by Mitty Hicks and published October 16, 2025 in Travel Noir magazine. I was on a walking tour with Dr. Joseph Fox along Asheville, North Carolina's Black Cultural Heritage Trail. We stopped in front of the YMI Cultural Center, one of the first black community centers in the country. We discovered buildings designed by James Vester Miller, a black architect who had no formal training. Miller built some of downtown Asheville's most iconic brick buildings that are still standing today. From there, we discussed some of the town's darkest history. On our tour, two or three placards in Asheville honor John Humphreys, Hezekiah Rankin, and Bob Brackett, memorializing three young black men who were lynched. We ended the walking tour at Pack Square Park in the middle of the Goombe Festival, one of the longest-running black cultural festivals in Asheville. The timing couldn't be more perfect. Unbeknownst to our tour group was Matthew Bacote Jr., a veteran and local legend who is credited with integrating bowling alleys in Asheville. In less than 2 hours, one thing was clear. Black people have a significant history and distinct culture in Asheville that is often overlooked. Most people associate the mountainous region in the eastern part of the United States known as Appalachia with white, rural, and flannel-wearing people. Aside from the flannels, because I visited 2 months before fall, this stereotype couldn't be further from the truth. Poet Frank X. Walker coined the term Afrolachia, capital A-F-F-R-I-L-A-C-H-I-A, in 1991 to describe the experience of African Americans in Appalachia. His goal was to challenge the traditional white-centric perception of the region. Afrolachia provides a name for the unique identity and experiences of African Americans in the region. It not only creates a sense of place and belonging, which is often overlooked, but also sheds light on how African Americans helped to shape the region. It's a term that recognizes that black people live and thrive in the mountains. Duane Barton, founder and CEO of Hood Huggers International, tells Travel Noir. Barton takes people on tours through Hood Huggers in his hometown of Asheville to explore African American history, culture, and traditions. Not only have black people always lived in the mountains, but we've done some incredible things here, such as building the railroad and creating successful communities, Barton adds. Contrary to popular perception, black people have lived in the region for centuries, dating back to the 1700s. While there is no single story of African Americans in Appalachia, they represented 10% of the population in 1860, as noted by Oxford African American Studies. As white people moved into the mountains, so did free and enslaved Africans. Scholars note that whites, Native Americans, and African Americans lived in proximity to each other in the early years of settlement. It's important to note that the region is named for the mountain range that runs from southern New York to northern Mississippi. It comprises three subdivisions, northern, southern, and central. Each region has its own history of settlement and race relations. For example, some historians believe that Native American nations such as the Cherokees held Africans in enslavement in the southern Appalachia region. The topography did not lend itself to the large plantation systems found in the Deep South. Still, slavery in the area is complex because Appalachia was divided by Civil War loyalties. Northern Appalachia joined the Union. The southern region joined the Confederacy. And those in central Appalachia were divided. In the 1830s, the construction of the Western North Carolina Railroad created a high demand for enslaved laborers in the area. Those who were enslaved were assigned to tasks such as digging track beds, laying tracks, and performing maintenance work. By the late 19th and early 20th centuries, African Americans, driven by the opportunity for work, migrated to the wider Appalachian region, including areas near Asheville, North Carolina, to work in the coal and steel industries. This was also a chance to escape the harsh conditions of the Jim Crow South and sharecropping. While black people in Asheville represent only about 10% of the total population, there are spaces, community organizations, and businesses working to preserve black Appalachian identity. Reclaiming the space isn't just about geography. It's about dignity, memory, and belonging. The black community was able to create their own businesses and communities at the height of Jim Crow segregation, Barton adds. There were black Wall Streets all over the country, including here in Asheville. To explore Appalachian culture, visitors should start with the Asheville Black Cultural Heritage Trail. A guide will take you through three communities, downtown, the South Side, and the River area. You will learn how black people from all backgrounds in Asheville built resilient communities through businesses, churches, and schools amid segregation. Guides will also educate people about local civil rights leaders, black unions, and the significance of the railroad that black Americans helped to construct. That was the article, Afrolachia Exists, The People Reclaiming Black Identity in Appalachia. This was written by Mitty Hicks and was published October 16, 2025, in Travel Noir magazine. My next reading is a profile of actor Tyler James Williams, who's known for his performances in the programs Everybody Hates Chris and Abbott Elementary. The title of this reading is Some Early Lessons Continue to Pay Off. This was written by Alexis Solosky and published in the New York Times newspaper on Sunday, October 19th, 2025. On the edge of Riverside Park in Manhattan, the actor Tyler James Williams paused to turn his digital camera toward an ascendant flock of pigeons. Pigeons are often considered an affliction of city living, but Williams enjoys them. "I like the way they move as a group," he said as he clicked. "I'm big on teams." That's lucky because for the past 4 years, Williams has been part of one of the more successful teams on television. On Abbott Elementary, the ABC mockumentary set in an underfunded Philadelphia public school, he plays Gregory Eddy, a serious-minded teacher who falls for his buoyant colleague, Janine, portrayed by the series creator, Quinta Brunson. Williams is a star of a show which recently returned for its 5th season, but not the star, and still he stands out. A former child actor, Williams, 33, endured some fallow young adult years to emerge as a skillful, wildly likable performer and more recently a director. The student is now arguably the teacher. On Abbott, he is quietly redefining what a male romantic lead can be, making a case, laugh by laugh, for the cute, sensitive normie. "I'm a very relatable heartthrob in Gregory," he said. This was a breezy fall morning on the Upper West Side. Williams wore sunglasses, a concession to the squinty brightness of the day, and a windbreaker over black pants. Fashion? Gregory would never. A baseball cap would have made him unrecognizable, but that, he said, would be akin to hiding. "Going outside to hide does something to me mentally," he said. "I think I've done that for the majority of my life. New York allows me to not have to hide." "New Yorkers," he said, "mostly leave him alone. Even the pigeons. It's one of the reasons he moved back here a few years ago from Los Angeles, where Abbott Elementary shoots." "Everyone's the main character of their own story," he said as he surveyed the dog walkers and stroller pushers. "Here, you're just another person." Williams' show business story started early. He grew up in Yonkers, just north of New York City. His parents weren't actors, and they didn't know anyone who was. But when Williams was 4, he saw the Will Smith film Men in Black, released in 1997. And something about that movie and that performance hooked him. "I can't even really fully explain it," he says. "It's one of the biggest moments of clarity I've ever had, and it's at 4. He knew in that moment that he had to be an actor. That same year, he found his way to Sesame Street, an ideal entry point. He was surrounded by other children and by adults uniquely interested and expert in what children needed on a set. He wishes that every child actor could start there. Throughout his elementary school years, the work wasn't overwhelming. He could still go to regular school and maintain regular friendships. That changed in 2005 when at 12, he was cast as the star of Everybody Hates Chris, a family sitcom originally airing on UPN, based on the early life of comedian Chris Rock. The actor Terry Crews, who played the father of Williams' character on the show, recalled his obvious talent. "Williams was line perfect," Crews said, "but he could also improvise, and he had a preternatural sense of where and how a joke should land. Honestly, I learned from Tyler even when he was a kid," Crews wrote in an email. "You could see that he wanted to be there. He enjoyed it, and it came through in every performance." Williams did enjoy it, but he also felt the weight of responsibility. As the star, if he failed, the show would too. He knew how fortunate he was, and it wasn't in his nature to act out or complain, so he didn't. But he does remember feeling a bone-deep fatigue. "It was the type of tired that I would go to sleep, take a nap, and I wouldn't recover," he said. This time, he went to school on set and experienced adolescent milestones in unusual ways. "Like for me, prom was the Emmys," he said. When Everybody Hates Chris ended after 4 seasons, Williams struggled with teen fare. He was slender, gangly is the word he likes, a consequence partly of Crohn's disease, and he found that casting directors were often looking for someone older and more filled out. There's not a lot written for actual teens and what they look like in their bodies, he said. Gradually, he became more selective. If he wanted longevity, he reasoned, he needed to vary his resume to argue for what he could do. Eventually, the roles came, though often on shows that didn't last long. Whiskey Cavalier, Criminal Minds, Beyond Borders. He had a multi-season arc on The Walking Dead and a role in the film Dear White People. When he was 26, he guest starred on a black lady sketch show, playing opposite Brunson in a Romeo and Juliet-inspired skit. They clicked immediately, bonded by shared work ethic. When he showed up, it just was very clear and very apparent that this person is a serious person, Brunson recalled. A few months later, Brunson began to imagine Abbott Elementary. She had Williams in mind for Gregory from the beginning and invested the character with that same seriousness and sense of mission. Because the role was largely written for Williams, the similarities are obvious. The no-nonsense attitude, the overthinking, the rigor, the sweetness. Both are particular around food. For example, Gregory insists fruit should not be hot. Though in the actor's case, this owes to the dietary restrictions of Crohn's disease. But Williams has more confidence than his alter ego, more comfort in himself. That comfort helped him to complicate Gregory. He took this character from someone who was a little bit more of a traditional leading man and turned him into this really interesting goofy guy, said Justin Halpern, a writer on the series. Williams still gets tired. He still gets stressed. But he takes comfort in knowing that the load is shared. His time in New York, in an apartment that overlooks the West Side Highway, where his mother used to drive him back and forth from Sesame Street, brings a kind of peace. He often spends his free hours just like this, walking around the neighborhood, camera in hand, seeing the world through the lens. The only picture on his Instagram that isn't strictly promotional is a selfie he took, in which the camera blocks his face. That makes a kind of sense, but what a loss. What a face. Williams isn't shy, but he doesn't seem to enjoy the more public-facing aspects of celebrity. He has been reluctant to discuss his personal life, and really, he said, there isn't much to discuss as the show keeps him too busy to commit to a serious relationship. So will it take cancellation for him to find love? That's not worth it, he said. But I do think there's a time for everything. Just give me a little bit. Still, the public curiosity is understandable, as Abbott has reinvented Williams as a hunk with a difference. In some ways, he is obvious as a romantic lead. I could have chemistry with a rock, he said. But his years in the business have revealed the limitations of trying, he said, to always be the really cool guy or really sexy. Halpern said, he's showing you it's okay to be curious and to be emotive, and it doesn't make you less masculine. Brunson added something similar. Young guys see themselves in him, flaws and all, she said. He's not afraid to still be funny or less than perfect. Williams is happy to model a more expansive vision of black masculinity. Being a role model, that's a weight too, but he doesn't mind. It's one of the best weights I've ever been able to carry, he said. Part of what I search for is freedom and liberation from those standards that feel unrealistic to some. As a director, Williams is also trying to model how a show that includes children can serve those children. He directed the Science Fair episode last season and is gearing up for one that he describes as equally, if not more, chaotic. Randall Einhorn, a veteran director on the series, noticed how Williams spoke to the young cast members. He wasn't talking down to anybody, Einhorn said. He's respectful of those young kids and he tries to speak their language. He knows to speak firmly and kindly, to encourage children to do their best without forcing them beyond their comfort or capabilities. You just want to rally them, Williams said, not intimidate or put pressure on them. Over a couple of hours in the park, Williams snapped pictures of a giant bug, a few trees, a lone pigeon that had separated from the flock and perched on the head of a statue of Eleanor Roosevelt. Behind the lens, he didn't have to perform for anyone else or meet anyone's expectations. One woman told him she loved the show and then sped on. "I can walk around and not be stopped along the way," he said approvingly. "It's like, thank you, let me continue. I'm in flow." That was the profile of actor Tyler James Williams titled, "Some Early Lessons Continue to Pay Off." It was written by Alexis Solosky and published in the New York Times newspaper on Sunday, October 19th, 2025. My next reading is titled, "Misty Copeland Hangs Up Her Point Shoes After Performing for Adoring Crowd at Retirement Show." This was written by Jocelyn Novick and published October 23, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. Misty Copeland took one last spin on her point shoes on Wednesday, October 22nd, showered with golden glitter and bouquets as she retired from American Ballet Theater after a trailblazing career in which she became an ambassador for diversity in an overwhelmingly white art form. Copeland, who a decade ago became the first black female principal dancer in the company's 75-year history, was feted in its star-studded fall gala at Manhattan's Lincoln Center. Oprah Winfrey and Debbie Allen were among those who gave speeches of praise. Winfrey spoke of the power of young people of color seeing Copeland lead iconic ballets like Swan Lake. "Misty didn't just perform ballet," Winfrey said of the ballerina, who has achieved a unique crossover fame. "She changed it. She redefined who belongs, who gets to be seen, and who gets to lead." In a way, the gala was both a return and a departure for Copeland, aged 43. She was dancing with the company for the first time in 5 years. During that time, Copeland has been raising a son, Jackson, with her husband. The 3-year-old came on stage to hug his mother during curtain calls wearing a tuxedo. Copeland has also been continuing her career as an author. The second volume of her Bunhead series appeared in September. And working to increase diversity in the dance world with her namesake foundation, including Be Bold, an after-school program designed for young children of color. But she decided to dust off the point shoes so she could have one last spin on the American Ballet Theater stage, including as Juliet, one of the most passionate roles in ballet and her personal favorite. Copeland's Romeo in the balcony was Calvin Royal III, who in 2020 became the American Ballet Theater's first black male principal dancer in 2 decades. The duo later reappeared for another duet, this time a modern one, in Rekka Stowe, W-R-E-C-K-A-S-T-O-W, by Kyle Abraham. For Copeland's final performance of the night, she performed Twyla Tharp's Sinatra Suite with another of her favorite partners, Herman Cornejo. The night, which also celebrated American Ballet Theater's 85th anniversary and was curated in large part by Copeland herself, included speeches and film clips about her career. And her fellow dancers performed excerpts of ballets in her honor. At the end, a beaming Copeland was giving a quintessential ballet farewell as colleagues, teachers, friends, and family came out to greet her one by one, with hugs and bouquets while glittery confetti poured from the rafters. The next part of the article is titled, "On to the Next Stage." Though Copeland has not closed the door on dancing altogether, it's clear an era is ending. "It's been 25 years at American Ballet Theater, and I think it's time," she told the Associated Press in an interview in June, when she announced her retirement. "It's time for me to move to the next stage." She added, "You know, I've become the person that I am today and have all the opportunities I have today because of ballet and because of American Ballet Theater. I feel like this is me saying thank you to the company. So it's a farewell, but it won't be the end of me dancing. Never say never." On the carpet Wednesday before her performance, she said, "I feel good. I feel ready to take this next step." She noted that she would be continuing her work promoting diversity. There's so much work and effort that has to be continuous. Allen told reporters that Copeland had helped to redefine the face of ballet. She inspired millions of people around the world, and hopefully American Ballet Theater will not wait another 50 years before they have another beautiful black principal dancer. The evening at Lincoln Center's David H. Koch Theater was streamed live to nearby Alice Tooley Hall across the plaza, with attendance free to the public, another sign of Copeland's unique style of fame in the dance world. Copeland was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and raised in San Pedro, California, where she lived in near poverty and through periods of homelessness as her single mother struggled to support her and five siblings. For a future professional dancer, she came to ballet relatively late, at 13, but soon excelled and went on to study at the San Francisco Ballet School and American Ballet Theater on scholarship opportunities. After a stint in the junior company, Copeland joined American Ballet Theater as a member of the Corps de Ballet in April 2001, becoming a soloist 6 years later. In June 2015, Copeland was promoted to principal dancer. Unlike other promotions, which are announced quietly, Copeland's was announced at a news conference, a testament to her celebrity. Only days before, she'd made a triumphant New York debut in Swan Lake in the starring role of Odette, drawing a diverse and enthusiastic crowd at the Metropolitan Opera House. The next part of the article is titled, "Trying Times for DEI Efforts." In the Associated Press interview, Copeland acknowledged that it's striking that when she leaves American Ballet Theater, there will no longer be a black female principal dancer at the company. "It's definitely concerning," Copeland said. "I think I've just gotten to a place in my career where there's only so much I can do on a stage. There's only so much that visual representation can do. I feel like it's the perfect timing for me to be stepping into a new role, and hopefully still shaping and shifting the ballet world and culture." She also noted that this is an especially trying moment for anyone working in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion. "It's a difficult time," she said, "and I think all we can really do is keep our heads down and keep doing the work. There's no way to stop the people that feel passionate about this work. We will continue doing it." That was the article titled, "Misty Copeland Hangs Up Her Pointe Shoes After Performing for Adoring Crowd at Retirement Show." This was written by Jocelyn Novick and published October 23, 2025, at the Associated Press's AP.com website. My next reading is titled, "The Slow, Painful Decline of Black Celebrity Activism." This was written by Andrew O'Hare and published October 18, 2025, at the website Salon.com. If the black entertainment world is any kind of barometer for the state of black America, something is amiss. Black athletes today are getting record NBA and NFL contracts. Black musicians like Kendrick Lamar and SZA are raking in millions, in their case, hundreds of millions of dollars, from globe-spanning tours. And after years of being denied film and TV's top roles and highest honors, black actors and actresses are now regularly cast in major projects, as well as nominated for and actually winning major awards. On top of this, many of today's top influencers are both young and black, attracting legions of followers and large coveted corporate sponsorships. Whatever the medium, art, sport, or digital, black celebrities are thriving, but they are flourishing within a kind of gilded age that is a deep remove from the rest of black America. Speaking as a black historian, I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that the 2020s have presented arguably the greatest sustained attack against black civil rights since the 1960s. I say this in considering just how successful contemporary coordinated efforts to roll back black Americans' gains in areas like education and employment have been. The Trump administration's effective demonization and banning of DEI programs and the ongoing acquiescence of higher education in corporate America to its requested purges is just one example of the gambit's potency. Even before Trump 2.0, though, there has been a widespread targeting of black civil rights, and voting rights in particular, at the state level. And overt forms of racism continue to be normalized in both American politics and the public square. By and large, the growing universe of black celebrities who are at the top of their game has had a muted response to these widening attacks on black America. In fact, as black entertainment has accumulated power and clout in recent years, becoming more visible, prolific, and profitable, there has arguably been a simultaneous and equal dip in black celebrity activism. There have been no notable calls for boycotts of companies that are retreating from DEI, which includes many a corporation in the entertainment and sports worlds, and no call for the kinds of organized protests for which black celebrities of yesteryear were renowned, and which often achieved complex outreach goals. Despite its controversies, celebrity activism has considerable practical value and indeed represents a storied part of American politics. Most celebrities naturally possess the communication skills and riz that we ordinary folk lack. We often find celebrities' rallying cries powerful, even when we don't like what they're saying, or when we recognize our connections to them as largely parasocial. To this end, Americans today have a strong, deep-seated distaste for entertainers speaking on politics. This isn't solely because we perceive celebrities these days as more detached. We resent the seemingly substantial advantage celebrities confer when supporting our adversaries. An Associated Press North poll conducted in December found that only 24% of people want celebrities to speak up about political issues. Those who want professional athletes to speak up on political issues ranked a smidgen higher at 26%. When certain populations like black people are considered, however, the desirability of celebrities' activism is much more fluid. Consider that the current decline of black celebrity activism comes at a time when there is a striking lack of Democratic political leadership, and especially black Democratic political leadership on the national stage. Dating back to the second wave of Jim Crow-style racism in the early 1950s, black celebrities have been critical in efforts to bring awareness to racial injustice and accountability to those perpetrating it. Black actors, musicians, and athletes sought to reach and engage with white Americans and policymakers alike who were uninformed about or indifferent to the sweeping impacts of segregation and state violence against black people. Aiming to boost their lesser-known liberal white allies in politics, black celebrities conveyed these messages while facing the very real threat of blacklisting and extrajudicial violence. In an alternative universe, one wonders whether Martin Luther King Jr. could have succeeded without the embrace of the likes of Jackie Robinson, Sidney Poitier, and gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, or if Malcolm X could have achieved mainstream validation absent his association with boxing legend Muhammad Ali. Where might civil rights for black people be today without the influence of these canonized black celebrities? And where will those rights be without that influence moving forward? In interviews and on social media, where entertainers are otherwise disposed and trained to flex their feats, leading black talents have been largely mum on black America's worsening plight. Whether this reflects a genuine lack of awareness or strategic ignorance, the dynamic reflects a palpable shift in the black collectivism that typified the civil rights era to one centered squarely and often unapologetically around black individualism. Following the dissolution of the old black celebrity guard in the late 1960s, the mantle of black celebrity activism remained dormant for years as civil rights expanded throughout the nation. The tradition was then briefly reawakened in the 1990s as the war on drugs began upending black communities. By hip-hop acts like N.W.A., Public Enemy, and my personal favorite, Tupac Shakur. It again lapsed until the early 2010s, when we saw the arrival of Beyoncé as a bona fide solo artist and a flood of young, socially attuned rappers like Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole. Beyoncé's contemporary catalog is sprinkled with references to black liberation and radical black feminism. But Queen Bey's public activism has been anything but. Like many other modern black celebrities, she has protested entirely in her art or via surface-level teases that fall short of any kind of organized call to action. Exhibit A, Beyoncé's tepid anticlimactic endorsement of Kamala Harris's presidential run in 2024, which both began and peaked with an 11th-hour, minutes-long pitch to Harris supporters at a rally in Beyoncé's native Houston. This kind of advocacy breadcrumbing has also reigned in the black sports world, where activism by the likes of NBA superstar LeBron James, who was told by a Fox News host in 2018 to shut up and dribble, following some pointed digs at Donald Trump, has arguably been even more subdued. Not since former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick began protesting racial injustice in America in 2016, by kneeling during the national anthem, has there been a powerful and consistent pro-black voice in American sports. It seems inarguable that Kaepernick's de facto blacklisting from the NFL following his protest has had at least somewhat of a chilling effect on black entertainers more broadly. To this end, no one has possessed as much unfilled promise in carrying the black celebrity activism torch as Kendrick Lamar. Known for highly sociological, race-aware raps that track well enough to routinely fluster pundits at Fox News, Lamar performed last February at Super Bowl 59. On that grand stage, many fans and political commentators expected a provocative display of black political thought, no less because newly elected President Trump was in attendance. At any rate, that was what I expected as a longtime Kendrick superfan. While Lamar's performance indeed touched a political third rail by embracing pro-black imagery and metaphors, the Compton, California native was demonstrably most in his zone by basking in coy slights to his rap nemesis, Drake. Drake, a rapper with a white Jewish mother and a black father, has himself been criticized for his relative silence on the Israel-Palestine conflict and inattention to black concerns more generally. That's another story. Even Spike Lee, who built a career celebrating black culture and spotlighting racism in the entertainment industry and in America writ large, is lately known more for his takes on his beloved but underachieving New York Knicks than on the current black political crisis. During a press conference in Cannes for his latest film, Heist 2, Lowest, a searing treatise on class and power, Lee, when prompted to weigh in on Trump, told reporters that his wife had told him to be very careful what you say, and he obeyed her dictum. Black celebrities' disposition, at best, gives us this. We care about what's happening, but don't count on any particular direct activism from us. The broader subtext to black America is clear, but damning. We embrace our excellence and our racial challenges at our own peril. That was a reading from Salon Magazine titled, The Slow Painful Decline of Black Celebrity Activism. It was written by Andrew O'Hare and published October 18th, 2025. My next reading looks at the world of theater. The title of the reading is, Once Lost, a 1935 play is brought to life. This was written by Salamisha Tillett and published in the New York Times on Sunday, October 19, 2025. The subtitle to the review is, Zora Neale Hurston's Spunk is getting its first full staging since its rediscovery in 1997. It has taken 100 years for Zora Neale Hurston's Spunk Banks, her charismatic guitar-playing starry-eyed protagonist to reach the stage. He's at the heart of Hurston's 1925 short story Spunk, and of the play she turned that story into a decade later. But when the play went unproduced, it was deposited in the U.S. Copyright Office, forgotten for decades. Now Spunk has come to vibrant life on stage at the Yale Repertory Theater. Like her groundbreaking novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, Hurston's 1935 play, Spunk has lively Black Southern vernacular, a self-actualized heroine and witty folk humor. But even after the book became canonized, Spunk remained essentially unknown for years. That's because, until its rediscovery in 1997, the play had languished in the Library of Congress's drama collections. But that only partly explains its absence. To mount a production as colorful and layered as her script envisioned, the play required not just critical will and patience, but also a creative team capable of delving deeply into Hurston's archives. Set in the rural, segregated South, the story follows Spunk, an outsider, as he falls in love with Evelina, a married woman, and their attempts to overcome the naysayers, neighbors, and even supernatural forces that try to prevent them from being together. When Hurston reimagined it as a play, she transformed it into a comedy, jettisoning its tragic elements and ending. She also incorporated folk songs, sermons, and sacred practices, like a conjure ceremony. After the prize-winning short story version of Spunk was published in the National Urban League's journal Opportunity, Hurston spent the next decade conducting ethnographic fieldwork in the South and the Caribbean, under the guidance of anthropologist Franz Boas. She recorded Black folk tales, music, and cultural traditions, even documented and at times participated in spiritual rituals. It was those experiences that led her to revisit Spunk and reshape it as a play. You can feel Zora trying to get at what it means to have agency and liberty in your life and mean not to be bound by what people tell you you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to do it, said Tamela Woodard, who is directing Spunk at Yale Repertory Theater. Woodard was a second-year Master of Fine Arts student in Yale's acting department in 2001 when Catherine Shee, a dramaturg and professor at Yale, heard a National Public Radio story about Hurston's unpublished works and quickly requested a copy of Spunk. "I read and loved it," Shee called. She started giving it to friends, sharing it with my students and passing it along to various directors, artistic directors, and choreographers. Spunk was one of 10 Hurston plays rediscovered, not to be confused with George C. Wolfe's 1989 staging of Spunk, an adaptation of three of Hurston's stories, Sweat, Story in Harlem Slang, and The Gilded Six Bits. The Library of Congress used to hold these scripts for authors who couldn't have a copyright on them because there was no production of them, Shee said. Then in the late 90s, they started going through their files to see what they had. The plays were written after Hurston moved in 1925 to Harlem from Eatonville, Florida, to pursue her first passion, drama. But only one of her plays made it to Broadway in her lifetime, Fast and Furious in 1931. And despite Hurston's posthumous acclaim, a stage production of Spunk wasn't a given. A 2021 Roundabout Theater Company hosted a virtual reading of the play, but the script itself is highly annotated with stage plans and production notes. The scripts have these little notations like, "Sing song here," and then there's nothing, said Jean Lee Cole, who with Charles Mitchell has edited two volumes of Hurston's plays. That was our biggest challenge. Another challenge was finding a creative team to stage the play. In the years since Shee first requested a copy of Spunk, Woodard had graduated and built her own career as a director. She is now the chair of the acting department at David Geffen School of Drama at Yale University and the resident director at Yale Repertory Theater. "She was the right person to lead it," said Shee, who gave Woodard a copy of the play in 2021. "It was the fullness of time that made the best possible outcome for this play." For Nehemiah Luckett, the production's composer and music supervisor. It also meant listening to Hurston's own voice in the music she and the ethnomusicologist Alan Lomax collected during her travels in the South. The first source material was the Library of Congress filed recordings that we had of Zora, in which we have the opportunity to hear Zora singing, which is phenomenal, Luckett said. I spent a lot of time listening to those recordings to get into the mood and the zone and the era. During a visit last month to a rehearsal at the Yale School of Drama, I witnessed J. Quentin Johnson, who played Spunk, and Kimber Elaine Sprawl, who played Evelina, give a marvelous rendition of the song Holly Mahfack. H-A-L-I-H-M-U-H-F-A-C, a song Hurston learned while traveling along the Florida coast. But it was through Woodard's research that another important discovery occurred. There is a photo from that time period of Zora on the beach with the musician Rochelle French and a well-known blues artist, Gabriel Brown, holding a guitar, she said. He might have been the origin of Zora's Spunk character. And given their similarities, also the muse for the freedom-seeking turned heartbreaking Tea Cake in Their Eyes Were Watching God. Luckett added, for the songs where we have lyrics but did not have music, it was actually just a very exciting journey of trying to write something that felt like it was of that time, but that would not be too unfamiliar to our ears today. As enriching as the music is, the choreography possesses its own electrifying dynamism, particularly in the movement featured in a work song set on a railroad track and a subsequent number at a juke joint where the lovers first meet. To create that meeting, the choreographer Nikki Douglas also turned to Hurston's research. There is a field research video that depicts what I think is a version of a song and a dance that we call Baby Child on the show, Douglas said. And the way that the children were playing the circle game, all of the physicality in that specific video really anchored my approach to the world of the movement throughout the show. But when I read the script myself, I was just moved by the lines like this. I done throwed up on a highway in the wilderness for you to walk on. A now widowed Lena confesses to Spunk as he tries to win her back, to which Spunk replies, in part, I'll tell you a parable, Lena. You know God got a long rail fence in heaven, made out of gold. And when he makes the people out of clay, he stands them up against that fence to dry. And when they's good and dry, he blows the breath of life in them and turns them go. The dialogue's rhythmic beauty was enhanced by the latitude Hurston gave directors to interpret a sacrosanct moment in the play. Conjure scene cannot be fully put on paper, must be done in direction. Building these moments for the stage entailed leaps of imagination and acts of faith among the collaborators. I'd say to the team, trust Zora. It's in the play. It's in the script. We just have to be able to see it, Woodard said. She noticed, for example, the reappearance of certain phrases as well as the likeness between the awakenings of Janine in Their Eyes Were Watching God and Lena in Spunk. For the conjure scene, part of the research was looking at the spell book and asking, what's the earth candle? And collectively reading every book at this point that she wrote. Or like Dust Tracks on the Road and Their Eyes Were Watching God, that happened around the same time or directly after the play. When Hurston arrived in New York during the Harlem Renaissance, a period of unprecedented creativity for black artists, she hoped to create what she called a new Negro play company. What people don't know is that she was a theater person. She loved theater. She was even a drama teacher for a short time, said Mitchell. And she was always trying to get her works produced. So there's kind of a what-if universe that she actually had gotten the opportunities she could have written the great folk musical, which didn't really exist during that time. Instead, she hit up against the competing demands on black performers. The first was the popularity of vaudeville, in which black actors often continued the racist stereotypes perpetuated by white actors performing in blackface minstrelly in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The second, espoused by black intellectuals such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Alan Locke, argued that the purpose of black theater was to dismantle racism and serve the cause of political progress and uplift. Hurston's vision was a stark contrast to those. She asked Langston Hughes, in a letter in 1928, "Did I tell you before I left about the real Negro art theater I plan? Well, I shall, or rather, we shall act out the folk tales, however short." She and Hughes later wrote the play Mule Bone, a comedy of Negro life, in 1930, which led to the dissolution of their friendship. Today, her celebration of the ordinary speech and otherworldly beliefs of early 20th century Southern black communities seems even more original. And now that Spunk is on stage, her omission from the American theater canon seems even more glaring. Hurston's deft ability to weave together humor and melodrama, music and movement, and bold statements about the vibrancy and complexities of black life, despite Jim Crow tyranny, are utterly distinctive and set her apart, said Daphne Brooks, a scholar of music and black studies at Yale University. Comparing Hurston to her contemporary Southern playwrights, DuBose Hayward, Carson McMullers, and Tennessee Williams. Her work exists outside the standard ways in which critics have defined black drama since the Harlem Renaissance. American theater critics and audiences largely weren't ready for her then, and I'm not sure if they are now. That was the theater review titled, Once Lost, a 1935 Play is Brought to Life. Zora Neale Hurston's Spunk is getting its first full staging since its rediscovery in 1997. This was written by Salamisha Tillett, S-A-L-A-M-I-S-A-H, and published in the New York Times newspaper on Sunday, October 19th, 2025. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.